Afternoon, I call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, May 3rd, 2024, and the time is 1:39 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Grinberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. The staff assisting us today is Talia with the Juneau LAO and Sophia with House Records. The following members present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Groh, Representative Sumner, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a quorum to conduct business. We have four items on today's calendar, and that is to hear Senate Bill 12, Address Confidentiality Program by Senator Keel, and then SB 134, Insurance Data Security by Senator Kaufman, and then to bring back House Bill 105 and House Bill 107 for the purposes of addressing updated fiscal notes for both bills. My apologies, that's an administrative oversight that we need to make a correction on. So first, on today's agenda item, we will hear Senate Bill 12, Address Confidentiality Program by Senator Keel in its first hearing. So if the two of you would please come to the table, state your names for the record, and then walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of serving as the senator for District B. With me is Ella Adkison of my staff. Senate Bill 12, thank you for hearing today. Senate Bill 12 creates an address confidentiality program. For administrative purposes, it's housed in the Department of Administration, where they have shared services of Alaska, so they handle mail. The reason for the bill is prompted by a story that a former member of the Senate who had worked in victim services once told, which I will relay. There was a woman who had needed to escape a violent relationship elsewhere. She moved to Alaska. She restarted her life and did and created the things that we all hope for in our lives in safe and healthy relationships in a safe place. She took the precautions that a person can take to protect her location and identity from being discovered by her former partner whom she had escaped. That included, among other things, keeping her home address private on her voter registration and using a post office box. And one day, that Alaskan went to the post office and very fortunately saw her former partner waiting in a car outside the post office before he saw her. That person had come to Alaska to find her. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we all do things, have a right to do things that sometimes create in the process of public record. To register to vote, to register a vehicle, we send our kids to school. The list could go on and on. 41 states have an address protection program like the one in Senate Bill 12 in order to protect people who need to keep their location secret. In simple terms, when someone has a protective order or otherwise qualifies to participate in this program, they get a post office box where their first class and registered official mail can go. This is not an Amazon package forwarding service, I hasten to note, but their mail can come. And then someone who works, a state employee who works in that program and has confidentiality rules for their conduct at work and to protect the list of confidential addresses, takes that person's mail and sends it to their actual address, which is not disclosed to the public. It's a simple step that allows them to live in safety. One different thing that is unusual compared to most states' address protection programs that you will see in Senate Bill 12, we allow peace officers and correctional officers to participate. The simple fact is, this is not an easy thing. It is an inconvenience. It is a delay to have your mail forwarded to you. This is not a thing that people will engage in lightly. Frankly, if a person has social media accounts and they're all over the internet, this won't do them any good. This program exists for people who have to restart their lives, or in the case of our correctional police officers, people who take seriously the training they are given at their academies to keep their addresses and their families' addresses confidential and private. It won't erase you from the internet, but if you take precautions from the outset, this will protect you. Madam Chair, a couple of other very small details. The first is that the CS before you was adopted by the House State Affairs Committee. It comes to you with no changes from their work. They closed a potential loophole. They forbade anyone who is required to register as a sex offender or child kidnapper from participating in this program. Their addresses will be listed on the registry. The other element that it is worth knowing, I made mention of a protective order as being the primary way that, folks will qualify for this registry. We also leave to the department the ability to work with victims protection organizations and create a pathway for folks who had to leave before they could get a protective order to qualify for the registry. We've worked with folks in the victims advocacy community. They do safety and protection plans, and I think there are good ways that the department will be able to make that workable, accessible, and practical. Madam Chair, it is a small program. It is a much needed program, and I thank the committee for your consideration. My staff is available if you would like a sectional analysis. Otherwise, we are available for questions.
Yes, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ella Atkinson, staff to Senator Keel. Section 1 of the bill puts the program in the Department of Administration. Section 2 creates the program, requires a single post office box for enrollees to use as a substitute mailing address for mail forwarding purposes, requires enrollees' real addresses be kept confidential, and describes program eligibility, requires state and municipal agencies to accept the P.O. box, and describes the eligibility period, forbids the department from charging a fee, allows access to confidential addresses subject to a search warrant, establishes penalties for unlawfully revealing a protected individual's address. Section 3 establishes a transition period for the department to adopt regulations to implement the program. Section 4 lets the department begin its regulation process immediately. And Section 5 sets an effective date of January 1st, 2025 for the rest of the bill.
Thank you. And I believe you have invited testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we have Keely Olson from Standing Together Against Rape.
Yes. Ms. Olson, if you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Keely Olson. I am the Executive Director of STAR, or Standing Together Against Rape, in Anchorage. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak today in favor of this bill. I'd like to thank Senator Keel for sponsoring this important piece of legislation. Prior to working at STAR here in Alaska, I was a victim advocate with the Prosecuting Attorney's Office in Washington State. Washington's address confidentiality program was an essential tool used by victim advocates to assist someone with high lethality risk to be safer. Combined with comprehensive safety planning and an emergency relocation plan, and done in a very particular order, the address confidentiality program was a lifesaver for more than a few of my clients. While the program was accessible and easy to use, I didn't ever see the program being used in inappropriate ways and never heard of it being a burden on state administrators. Address confidentiality programs, as stated, are currently available in up to 40 states nationwide at no cost to enrollees, which is an important consideration for those sometimes fleeing abuse with little access to funds. I also know law enforcement officers and district attorneys personally who use public and private names and put their own real estate and personal property in a spouse or family member's name to protect their addresses. So I can certainly appreciate the reason for the inclusion of public servants serving in law enforcement as well. I did actually last year take the opportunity to contact my home state of Montana. Their program has been in effect since 2006, and I just had some questions of their program administrator about the cost of the program in Montana. She informed me that its initial implementation cost about $50,000. Since that time, 68 people were enrolled in the program, and only about 20 people got their mail through the program on a consistent basis. I didn't think to ask if there was a way to disenroll from the program or if people just started using alternative addresses when they felt they no longer needed the program. Since its inception, the cost of the program as of last May 2023, when I reached out to Montana, was $375,000 over 17 years. The cost was essentially a portion of a salaried employee, the Secretary of State's office, with one backup person for redundancy in case of being on leave. Therefore, the confidential addresses were only accessible to two people in the entire state. So it seemed like it was a very cost-efficient program for the safety that it was able to allow survivors. So thank you very much for having the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Olson. Do we have any questions? Hearing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any final wrap-up, Senator Q? Or for the first? Oh, my apologies. And for the record, we have been joined by Representative Allard at 150. So we do have one amendment before the committee by Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, I move Amendment 1.
There's an objection. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment 1 to Amendment 1.
Object.
It's a conceptual amendment. Through the chair, if I could explain the amendment.
Representative Sumner.
So page 1, line 6, after election, insert or elected. Page 2, line 11, after election, insert or elected. Page 2, line 12, strike or. After worker, insert or person elected to any municipal or state elected office. And this would extend the same protections for elected or election officials as elected officials. And I raise this because I think there's a number of surveys that talk about the number of threats that elected officials have received. I've personally received threats. I think it would be an important thing, especially for municipal elected officials. And I think possibly another member of this committee might sympathize, but to protect these folks and in particular the municipal elected officials who really, you know, are almost volunteers, very low pay at most of these elected official positions, and need to be able to make their decisions free from coercive threats. Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Sumner? Representative Gray.
Through the chair to the sponsor of the bill, can I get their opinion on this amendment to the amendment?
Senator Keel.
Madam Chair, maybe I will just speak with your indulgence to the notion as a whole. The clients of address protection registries generally tend to live very private lives, and for the most part, that's a result of having survived or having escaped terrible violence or terrible threats. I am not aware of any significant use of address protection registries in other states from people who live the exceedingly public lives that folks in public office do. I certainly understand the desire and the need to keep one's family safe. That is paramount to anyone. and so I think then we have a slight difference between those of us who put our names on ballots and our faces on ads and those who work the polls. Without desiring to minimize anyone's need ever for protection, I will raise, I guess, a concern broadly that this bill does have a fiscal impact, and I think that fiscal impact is entirely justifiable. I don't have a good way to estimate what the increased cost would be from significantly increasing the number of eligible people, and so I leave those questions and thoughts to the will of the committee.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And to the maker of this conceptual or amendment to the amendment, I appreciate it, because here's the one question I have. We don't stay in office. Well, some of us don't stay in office our entire lives. So that is where I think it's very significant. And I will just say I've had a file with the FBI, so from people across state lines. So I would support this amendment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if we, and I know we don't, have someone from APOC or the Division of Elections, because when we file our disclosure reports, we have so many reports that we have to file that I don't know what the impact on them would be having to forward. So I'm not sure I support the First Amendment. And although I understand the sentiment, I just don't know how that's going to affect APOC and the openness that we strive for in elections. So I'm just curious if that's a, to me it's a concern, but I don't know if it is to anyone else.
Maybe
Vice Chair Allard.
Sorry, maybe perhaps, because I think what Senator Keel's brought before us is very important. Maybe we could look at doing yours as a different avenue or vehicle in itself.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate the concerns about the fiscal impact. I think there's a substantial number of election officials in this state as well, though. And so were we to extend it to election officials, I don't know why we wouldn't extend it to elected officials. I think most forms you can put an address on, and it could be a P.O. box. You know, I have four little kids at home, and I don't particularly want every single, and there's some less than sane people out there, you know, going to my house while I'm here, and my wife is home alone with the four little kids. So I do feel if we are going to expend the cost on election officials, who I think are, I believe, under substantially less threat than elected officials, then I don't understand why we would not expand that to elected officials.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is in line with Representative Johnson's. If this were to apply to elected officials, I wonder if there might be a loophole to not live in your district anymore, to move outside your district and have a confident. I know it might sound crazy, but if your address is completely confidential and doesn't have to be shared with anybody, then, and you're just using a PO box, then you could live in a different district and run for another district. And I know that may sound crazy, but there are people who may try to do that. And so I want to know from APOC that if your address is completely confidential and cannot be shared, how do we assure that people live in the district that they represent? And I know it sounds crazy, and I know you're giving me a lot of looks. So I guess.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. No, wasn't trying to give you looks. So if that came across that way, Representative Gray, I apologize. There are other ways. So when they pull up our information of our voting status, it's public. So there's a lot of things that are public. People can find us. And I think this is just an avenue that I feel is safe. And I still agree with his amendment, but if you pull up whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat, that's all public. It's in the system. So I don't think it would impact where we live as elected officials, is all I'm saying.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would correct one thing. You can obscure your voting registration, but that doesn't remove the requirement to have a physical address when you register or when you register to run.
Senator Keel.
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner is correct. We have worked with the Division of Elections as well as with municipal clerks, and they will retain the ability to know where a registered voter lives so as to put them in the correct precinct, which would allow them to locate where a candidate lives. So there's not a technical issue with that element. And I wanted to reassure the committee that we have worked through those issues with election officials without getting into the committee's policy discussion on the amendment.
So I completely understand. I think everyone understands the sentiment of having elected officials, and this is speaking to conceptual amendment number one, have the confidentiality. However, when you run for office, you are no longer anonymous in the public. And our communities are just too small. My children bear my face. People know where I live. If I were to be a part of this program, people would still know where I live. I had my children were walking in my neighborhood, and a high school classmate who hadn't seen me in many, many years saw my children and said, "Hey, is your mom Sarah Vance?" And they were kind of surprised. And it's because we simply can't be anonymous. Now, not all of our children look exactly like us, but people talk in our communities. They know where we live. They know what vehicles we drive, things like that. And when we run for public office, we choose to no longer be hidden. And I want to support the original intent of this confidentiality program, as the sponsor has brought forward, that these are people who have been in highly abusive situations where they are having to just go offline to the most practical sense that they can. As the sponsor said, they can't have a social media presence. They have to watch to make sure that they are safe in every sense of the word. And yes, there are other people who get threats and are in harm, as Vice Chair Allard mentioned. But I think that's a risk as elected officials that we take. We choose that when we run for public office, that we are exposing ourselves and our families to that scrutiny and that danger. So I can't support that for this, because it is a very conscious decision that we have to make as elected officials, as challenging as that may be. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you to Chair Vance for her comments, and I will kindly disagree. My children didn't sign up for this. Neither did my husband. I want to protect them at all costs. I don't think this is going to incur too much of a fiscal note. And when I leave public office, I want myself protected. And if you've ever had to call the FBI or the APD or anybody else to protect you or your children because your children's lives were threatened, I think it's very important. So I will continue to support this amendment.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the maker of the amendment, would it apply to former elected officials? Because I've heard the vice chair mention several times that when she leaves public office, but once you leave public office, would this still apply to you?
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would be my intention that it does. There may be some ambiguity, but it just says, or person elected to any municipal or state elective office. So elected would always be in the past tense. It doesn't say serving. It just simply says a person that was elected to one of those offices. So it doesn't say elected and serving. So I that would be my intent, and I would think that would be what that outcome would be.
Follow-up, Representative Gray.
So this is my thought on it through the chair. As somebody who had threats on their child last week, I definitely wish that all my information was confidential, but I agree with Chair Vance. I think that if people want to find our address, they're going to find it. And we're going to have a social media. Most elected officials have a social media presence. Most elected officials have to be in the public eye. And I believe that the intent of this bill is to protect folks in domestic violence situations who have real threats on their lives. The bottom line is that as much as it may upset me that I have online threats against me and my family, most of those people are never going to actually do anything. And I think I'm going to stand with the chair on this one. Thank you.
I just want to say that, you know, Vice Chair Allard is highlighted that there have been significant threats, you know, to her family. And I think a lot of us are not exempt from that. Hers did raise to a higher level, so I don't want to diminish that in any way. I just find the practicality of truly becoming anonymous will be very, very difficult. Not impossible, but very difficult. But I believe that you know, we should seek every possible means to protect our loved ones and our vulnerable. And you know, I respect the position that our members have on this, because it does get personal very, very quickly. And I too have had threats against me and my children. But we're being wise and doing everything that we can. And so, Representative Sumner, do you have any final wrap up before we vote on conceptual amendment number one?
No, Madam Chair.
Would the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Johnson is not present. Representative Sumner?
Yes.
Representative Gray?
No.
Representative Groh?
No.
Representative Allard?
Yes.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Chair Vance?
No.
Yeas and three nays.
By a vote of 2 yeas and 3 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 has failed to pass. That puts us back to amendment number 1 by Representative Gray. Does anyone have any other questions on amendment number 1? Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, can I speak to my amendment?
Some more, yes.
Thank you. So what Amendment 1 would do is add election officials to the category that would be protected. And where this amendment really grows is from the 2020 election. We saw in Georgia an election worker who was falsely accused of tampering with a ballot, with tampering with ballots. And it was found that it was false. But her address was public. She was flooded with threatening messages, including several that mentioned lynching. A crowd of people showed up at her home with bullhorns. She believed that they had come to hang her. She testified under oath that she believed she was going to be killed. The FBI told her that she was not safe. She was forced to flee her home. This is Ruby Freeman, if you want to look it up. Ruby Freeman in Georgia. She was forced to sell her home. And I believe that with those kinds of threats happening to folks working in elections, very, you know, people showing up at your home with bullhorns, I think that if we want free and fair elections, we need folks who are willing to work our elections. And I believe that at this state moment in time, it is a real threat. I did include in the email a letter from the Alaska Association of Municipal Clerks. I'll quote from that letter. It says, in recent years, election officials, defined as municipal clerks, staff, polling place workers, and other election workers have been targeted with harassment, slander, and threats to their personal health and safety, as well as the well-being of their family members. They have asked for this amendment. And in light of recent history, I believe the amendment is worthy.
Questions on amendment number one? Representative Gray, for the same reasons, well, not exactly the same, I cannot support this, because my question would be, where would we stop on people who do public service, you know, working, people who work for the state? There were threats on a variety of people who work for the state. Because people were unhappy about certain things. And those should be followed up with public safety, which it sounds like in that particular instance in Georgia it was. But this particular program, I think, is for, like you said, it's people who have experienced the domestic violence. They're having to essentially disappear. And I feel for the people who have had those threats, you know, that they should receive every protection that we can provide under the law. But I think this is a different, the bill addresses a different situation. But thank you for highlighting the concern, because we do need people to serve to provide free and fair elections. And it is my hope that we do not have that conduct in Alaska. Any final wrap up on amendment number one?
Sure, Madam Chair. So the difference between an elected official who basically knows they're going to be in the public eye and somebody working at a poll, for example, is that somebody working at a poll just wants to make sure that the election goes off, make sure that someone's there to show people the way in. And I think the example that we had in Georgia is somebody doing that job could lose their home. And so I think just given the fact that these are not people signing up to be in the public eye, not signing up to have publicity, that they, in order for us at this moment in time in our country and in our state to make sure that we have Alaskans who are still willing to do this work, that we can say, you know what, your election won't, your address won't become public. You can keep your address private so that what happened in Georgia won't happen to you here.
Thank you. Vice Chair Allen.
Thank you. And I just wanted to respond by saying those election officials went to the media, the press, urged people to vote, said all their names on file, on record, and on the TV. So I'm not going to support this amendment because they did make themselves public even before the elections.
Would the Secretary please call the roll on amendment number one?
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Grove.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Representative Johnson. Chair Vann.
No.
Two yeas and three nays.
By a vote of two yeas and three nays, amendment number one has failed. I believe that concludes our amendments on SB 12, and I will now open public testimony on Senate Bill 12. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony on Senate Bill 12? Seeing none, I will now look online. I do not see anyone online. I will close public testimony on Senate Bill 12. If there is anyone watching online who did not have an opportunity to testify, please email your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be submitted to the public record. So Senate Bill 12 is now before us. Do we have any final questions on this bill? Does the sponsor wish to make any closing arguments? Oh.
One question.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor of the bill. The question is, I think, a little bit more of a, I guess, a technical question, but is the participant's address somehow purged from wherever it's already listed, and how does that happen?
Madam Chair, excuse me, in answer to Representative, oh, and for the record, Jesse Keel, Senate District B, in answer to Representative Gray, Madam Chair, The participating in the address protection registry does not in itself purge anything. These registries tend to be of greatest use to people whose situations force them to pick up stakes and start again. It is and perhaps the most important thing to think about in the practical realities of how this works is that you can't erase stuff from the internet. But if we look to a situation like our peace officers or correctional officers who go to the academy, if they then purchase a home rather than rent, they're probably going to need to create a trust because in order to keep that record from ever becoming available on the internet. They will not, however, need to go to extraordinary lengths to do all of the other things, right, to register to vote and keep their address protected and prevent access to their post office box, to register their kids for school, to do register their vehicles, right? There's a way you can get access to the registered address of a vehicle, and you have to certify under almost no penalty that it's not for an improper purpose. But so they need not fear in all those things. You can't go backwards. I hope that is responsive, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think that provided a lot of clarification on some things. Any more questions from committee members? Thank you so much. Vice Chair Allard, do I have
a
motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the House Judiciary Committee move SB 12 version 33 LS0162H from committee with the attached fiscal notes and give Legislative Legal Services permission to make all technical and confirming changes as necessary.
Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 12 has moved from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the report. Back on the record, for our second item on today's agenda, we will hear Senate Bill 134, Insurance Data Security, by Senator Kaufman in its first hearing. So I'd like to invite Senator Kaufman and his staff to the table. If you could please state your name for the record and begin walking us through the bill.
Need to make sure that chair is under me before I sit down. So thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator James Kaufman, District F, Anchorage. And Senate Bill, and I want to thank the committee, the chair and the committee for hearing this bill. Senate Bill 134 addresses the increasing concern over data breaches within the insurance industry over the last several years. These companies maintain sensitive personal, financial, and health information of thousands of Alaskans, and is important to establish guidelines and standards to reduce the potential damage of data breaches within the industry. Senate Bill 134 would require state-licensed insurance companies to perform a full risk assessment of their internal and external threats, and then develop, implement, and maintain an information security program based upon those threats. This bill sets forth standards of governance, risk assessment, risk management, third-party risk management, and incident response. The bill empowers the Division of Insurance with the tools necessary to effectively oversee the protection of Alaskans' sensitive personal information by licensees. Similar legislation already exists in at least 23 other states, and the federal government has urged states to adopt similar measures, reflecting a nationwide recognition of the importance of these provisions. SB 134 is a proactive approach to protecting Alaska citizens' personal information from cyber threats and will enhance consumer protections and bolster cybersecurity positions in the insurance industry. And to develop this legislation, we began with an NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, model piece of legislation. Then we worked extensively with the department and with stakeholders in the industry to right-size it and create provisions that specifically work for Alaska, the Alaska market, and the type of insurers that we have here in terms of size and scope. So additionally, after this bill was put together, in consultation with others in the House and Senate, we agreed with including the provisions related to mammography screening, diagnostic breast examinations, and supplemental breast examinations to ensure that these examinations are covered at no cost to the insured under applicable insurance plans. So I want to thank the committee for that. And then if the committee desires, my staffer can go over the sectional if it's the will of the committee.
Does the committee need a sectional at this time? I don't believe so. I do see brief at ease. Back on the record, I was just getting clarification of who we have as invited in public testimony. So if there are not any specific questions from committee members, we have Emily Nanon from the American Cancer Society Action Network. If you could please state your name for the record, you will have 3 minutes. She is invited testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Vance and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Nanon. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, which is the advocacy arm of the American Cancer Society. And I'm here to speak to that newer piece of this bill, which I know you all have had some discussion about before, which is the addition of removing cost sharing, so removing the cost to the patient for getting a follow-up mammogram, a diagnostic mammogram if necessary, or some of the supplemental breast imaging if somebody's at high risk for breast cancer. Want to flag that while this bill only addresses the state-regulated insurance plans, that really is the bellwether for what happens with the rest of the insurance plans offered in the state. I've been working on these sorts of issues for many years, even predating the Affordable Care Act. And what we've seen is that this is setting a standard which other plans will want to meet, and I'm excited to see this moving forward. One quick story I'll share with you as this issue has come up. I've heard so many people talking about what a barrier it can be having that cost to get in after you've done your regular screening, but maybe facing a large bill to get in to do any follow-up that may be necessary. I spoke with an imaging center director just recently who said that his scheduler had gotten a call from a woman who said she had had a suspicious mammogram, screening mammogram, a year and a half earlier. She had been setting aside money every single month, and she was calling to find out if she'd saved enough money yet to get in for that diagnostic mammogram. You all know, we know, the sooner you can detect cancer, the quicker you can cure it and move on with your life, save the system costs and save families costs. So I encourage your support for this provision. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Before I move on to public testimony, does the sponsor have any more information for us on the introduction?
No, ma'am. Unless through the chair, unless there's any questions, but other than that, we have the sectional, but I think the committee's familiar with it at this point, so we'll just continue if it's the will of the committee.
Great. Thank you. So I will now open up public testimony on Senate Bill 134. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anyone. We have a couple of people online. First, we will go to Connor Sweeney. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to comment. For the record, my name is Connor Sweeney. I'm a regional manager of state policy and advocacy with the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. I'll keep my comments brief. My colleague from the American Cancer Society did a great job in summarizing the need for this bill. I want to emphasize the critical importance of this legislation for women and families across Alaska. Far too often does my organization hear from patients who have gone in for a routine screening mammogram only to find out that there is cause for concern and that they're going to need to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars out of pocket to rule out the possibility of cancer or to diagnose it. And unfortunately, many patients must choose to delay or forego that medically necessary diagnostic because they can't afford it. When it comes to diagnosing cancer, starting treatment, every second counts. And every day that goes by, the patients delay these medically necessary services, they risk seeing their cancer spread and become far more difficult and costly to treat. To put it simply, this bill would eliminate those hefty out-of-pocket costs and save lives. We respectfully ask that you join us in our mission to eliminate deaths from breast cancer and support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Kelly Marr. If you would please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Hi, I'm Kelly Marr, and I'm from Pisilof. And I am also in support of this part of the bill to remove the cost-sharing part for patients when they have to get additional testing. I also work as an oncology social worker, and so each week I'm talking to women who this has been a barrier for them. They have not been able to afford to get that additional testing that they need to get. I talked to one patient recently who had breast cancer, was treated, and she needs additional follow-up, and she can't afford it. And so even though, you know, she has this opportunity to get the screening to prevent because she's high risk, but she doesn't feel like she can afford it because she's still paying off her other treatment. And so it's you know, it's such a shame to see somebody not be able to afford this, because as I heard Emily Meehan's testimony earlier, people can go from an early stage breast cancer diagnosis to a stage four quite rapidly. And so I do urge you to pass Senate Bill 134. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I believe that concludes our public testimony, so I'll now close public testimony in SB 134. For those watching online who did not have an opportunity to testify, you can email your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be submitted to the public record. So we do have five amendments before the committee, and the sponsor has made a request for an amendment that is mine. So, Vice Chair Allard.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number one.
Object.
There has been an objection. Would the sponsor please speak to the need for amendment number one?
Yes, ma'am. Through the chair. With respect to this amendment, electronic was referenced in the original NAIC model to confirm the scope of the bill applied specifically to cybersecurity. Deleting the word may cause some confusion, so we're adding it back in for clarification, just to be specific that this is about cybersecurity. The notice by third parties was amended to align with the requirements under existing law relating to disclosures of personal information. And this notice applies to licensees, consumers.
Thank you. Do you have any questions on amendment number one? Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question focuses around the change from notifying consumers with no later than 3 business days after their data has been breached to changing to it as soon as possible and without a reasonable delay. How fast is as soon as possible and without unreasonable delay?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Gray. The industry endeavors to respond as quickly as they can, but there can be challenges in being specifically within that time limit. Because of the technical nature of some of the aspects of this bill, we had to work really closely with the director, Director Wingheyer, who's here today. If we want to dive deep, I'm sure she would come up and help us with some of these, but essentially it's about being prescriptive around something that there may be challenges in reacting that quickly, but it's just a practical concession to the industry.
Follow-up?
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment one to amendment one.
Object.
And what is your conceptual?
On lines 3 and 4 of amendment one, remove the words "and without unreasonable delay" and replace it with "not later than 5 business days. And the reason for that is that if my credit card number is stolen, if my banking information is stolen, if my social security number is stolen, I don't want more than a week to go by before I'm informed. I think that having a very specific time that the consumer knows when they have to be notified of a data breach is better than having the vague language of "as soon as possible without a reasonable delay," especially if they're changing that because they felt that 3 business days was too short for them to notify consumers. So I think I understand that that's a short time. I'm willing to expand it to 5 business days. If you add the weekend, that's a whole week that you wouldn't know that your financial information or your social security number had been stolen. So I think this is a reasonable compromise, in my opinion.
Any questions on conceptual amendment number one? Representative Groh.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be real interested, as we go through all these amendments, I see the Director of the Division of Insurance here. I'd be very interested in what the Director of the Division thought as to all these amendments, as to what their perspective was on it, and also what the effect of the amendments would be. So that's what I would seek and ask for, Madam Chair.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I notice it's referencing a third-party service provider, so I'm not certain that they would necessarily have at hand the contact information of those folks or be able to obtain it within 5 days. But I think maybe that part of the reason why it's as soon as possible and without unnecessary delay.
Ms. Wingheyer, would you join us at the table?
For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Madam Chair.
If you would please address the concern of the words unreasonable delay and conceptual amendment number one that would put 5 business days.
If I may, with this amendment is written for insurance companies that use vendors, and the vendors have all of our information. They do algorithms with it. They do background checks. They just have as much information in a lot of cases as the insurance company does of yours. This amendment came about because Senator Keel thought that the contractors or the vendors should notify the insurance company, not the consumers, but the insurance company that there had been a breach. And I can see where Representative Gray, that to bring that down to 5 days, 7 days, but to give them a time frame would be better than as soon as possible. And again, all they're doing is having to tell the insurance company, I don't regulate the third-party service providers, I regulate the insurance companies. The insurance company then has 3 days to tell me to get to you as consumers that your data has been breached.
Vice Chair Allen.
Does anybody on this body, thank you, Madam Chair, remember when the elections and all our stuff was breached? That took a really long time. That was unacceptable. I appreciate what you're saying. So, yeah, I think we need to take a closer look at shortening the length, because when you just leave it wide open, that can become a problem. And I know that the sponsor's going to want to make a comment. And I'd like to hear from you, Senator Kaufman.
I believe that it's beneficial, through the chair, that it's beneficial to shorten it. But I also know that there can be management challenges in doing so. But I'll go with the will of the committee.
Let me do it quick.
Vice Chair Allard.
Yeah, I was just looking. And, you know, some places are 45 days. And so I don't know. I'm a little bit worried about the five-day mark. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to make another comment on it or anything, like expand?
Senator Kaufman?
No.
Well, I would say if you're going to put days, I know through the chair, if there's the desire to put a specific number of days, I'd just be careful in creating a trap that where compliance, if you have, you know, layers of vendors to go through. So, I don't know, 10 days on the just to provide enough of a stack of days, but Director Wing-Heyer may have a suggestion.
Director Winkler, could you?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I'm sorry, we would be okay with 10. I mean, it's still better than as soon as possible, where then we would be arguing with the insurance company to argue with their provider, their vendor.
Can I change my...
Could
withdraw and re-off.
Representative Sumner.
I'm not done talking.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just saying perhaps the sponsor of the amendment, conceptual amendment, might want to withdraw and offer a new conceptual amendment. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, I withdraw Amendment 1 to Amendment 1 and move Amendment 2 to Amendment 1, which would, on lines 3 and 4 of Amendment 1, remove the words, quote, and without unreasonable delay, end quote, and replace it with, quote, and not later than 10 business days, end quote.
I object for purposes of discussion.
There's been an objection. Any further discussion on conceptual amendment number 2? Ms. Wing-Heyer.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, in our statutes, we don't use business days, we use working days. And if we could have it as working days, just to be with what is with the, in this bill everywhere else and other parts of our statute. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, I withdraw Amendment 2 to Amendment 1, and I move Conceptual Amendment 3 to Amendment 1. On lines 3 and 4 of Amendment 1, remove the words, quote, and without unreasonable delay, end quote, and replace it with, quote, and not later than 10 working days, end quote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll object.
There has been an objection. Representative Allard.
No, if anybody doesn't have any comments, I'll remove it.
Representative Sumner.
I support the amendment.
I remove my objection.
The objection has been removed. Conceptual amendment number 3 to amendment number 1 has been adopted. So that puts amendment number 1 as conceptually amended before us. Do we have any further questions? Brief at ease. Amendment number 1 is conceptually amended. Is the objection to amendment number 1 maintained?
I remove my objection. Wait.
Hearing no further objection, amendment number 1 has been adopted.
Amended.
As amended. Representative Groh.
I'm not going to offer amendment number 2.
Amendment number 2 is not being offered.
I offer amendment number 3.
Object.
There's been an objection. Representative Groh.
Madam Chair, thank you. Currently the language says an insurance company will certify. The way that that language is phrased, it sounds sort of like we're expecting the licensee to self-certify without oversight. If I change the language to demonstrate, we're saying the exceptions, the licensee will first lay out their evidence, and then the Division of Insurance is responsible for checking for compliance with the law. Rather than having a rubber stamp, this then would become a consideration, become a conversation. And Madam Chair, I would ask, as I have before, for the views of the Director of Insurance on this matter.
Ms. Wingheyer.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Lori Wingheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. To Representative Groh, through the Chair, we did meet with your staff on this. I don't know that it makes a whole lot of difference if it's certifying as opposed to documenting or written statement as opposed to report, but that's certainly a call of the legislature if you want to change it that way.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wouldn't certifying imply that they're saying that any omission in the written statement that they're certifying they're in compliance with the statute. So even if there was an omission, they would still be held accountable if they're not in compliance. Whereas if they just have a report demonstrating and there's by some omission, they're maybe less liable. Does that make sense? Or
through the chair to Representative Sumner. No, I see what you're saying, sir. And I think to us in insurance, certifying is a higher level of saying that you have complied or you haven't complied, or information you're submitting to me is the best to your knowledge, that when you're certifying, you've done all you're supposed to do, dotted your I's and crossed your T's to the best of your knowledge. I hope that answers your question, sir.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the maker of the amendment, based off of Representative Sumner's question, that certifying is a higher standard, would we want to change it to a lower standard word?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, it's not my intent. My intent, and I really appreciate this colloquy through the chair to the Director of Insurance, as long as you can, as we say, certify that this language of certification will provide the greater protection. I'd be very interested in you saying that, if that's what you mean, as explicitly as possible in what this amendment would provide.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, yes. As I said, we take certifying as a much higher standard than documenting. That when the CEO of the company or the attorney of the company signs a document for me, that they are certifying that all is correct, everything they know they've told me, we take that to a higher degree.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Groh.
Then this approach and this amendment of demonstrating in terms of creating the dialogue to propel that forward to make sure you're saying that the certifying would be a better process for the consumer and for the state.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, yes, sir.
Thank you. Based on that, I'm going to withdraw amendment number 4.
Amendment number
3. So number 3, I apologize.
Amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Representative Groh.
I'm not going to offer amendment number 4.
Amendment number 4 is not being offered. Representative Groh.
Amendment, Madam Chair, I offer and move amendment number 5.
There's been an objection. Representative Groh.
So what this would do, this proposed amendment would create a reliable time frame, and it would try to, and it would move us forward. So in terms of when the records are produced. So right now it says shall produce the records at the request of the director. This says within 90 days of a request of the director. And once again, I'd ask through the chair for the director of division of insurance their views on this.
Ms. Wingheyer.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at what I believe on page 14, line 6.
Page 8. Oh, no, it's amendment number 5.
Are we at number 4? I'm sorry, ma'am.
Number 5.
Okay, sorry.
Which, if I may be so bold, amends page 8, line 15.
Maybe I could address this while we're waiting.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could sort of see value in this amendment either way, because it creates a time certain after the request that they have to deliver. But if you don't have it and it's simply at the request of the director, then perhaps this is information that they're responsible for always having updated and at the ready, which I could also see value in. So I'm actually kind of unsure which way I would want to go, but definitely want to hear from the director on this.
Vice Chair Allard.
Yeah, I'm reading this amendment and reading what we already have in statute. I don't support this amendment.
Ms. Wingheyer.
Madam Chair and two various committee members, I'm going to be real honest with you here. I am very proud of my staff. I'm not sure that we are IT experts enough to know that we can tell you if you're, to give you commensurate with the size and complexity of a license, the director shall establish by regulation the standards. I don't know that we have that capability internally. I mean, we do a lot with what we have, but I don't have an IT person sitting on my staff to go into State Farm, Allstate, the broker down the street, and tell you if the IT program is suitable for their size. I'm sorry, we just don't.
Vice Chair Allard.
Okay, due to your character and your integrity and your honesty, you just moved up to be like the number one favorite commissioner of mine. But I'm still not in favor of this amendment.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is stemming off of Representative Sumner's line, which is that I read Section C as the licensee must maintain records concerning all cybersecurity events for the last 5 years. They must maintain it at all times. So to me, when they ask for the report, it should be fairly readily available. I think 90 days is entirely too long. To me, 3 months after we've asked for your records is 3 months for me to think that things could, you know, I think 90 days is too long, in my opinion. If you're maintaining records at all time as you should be, then I think that this should be a shorter time period. That's my opinion.
Madam Chair, have we moved on to amendment? What I show is H.10?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. That's what we're working on.
Okay, I thought we were working on H.5.
No, we're on
H.10.
Sorry.
Maybe this should help provide some insight for you.
Okay, page 8, line 15.
Correct.
Through the chair, Madam Chair, to Representative Gray, at least 5 years complies with our current statutes as far as record retention, and that's why we worked on that number. I would tell you that I believe that 90 days is a long time.
Madam Chair, I'm fine. We'll go with shorter. But I do think it's useful to have some sort of time limit to move this along, Madam Chair.
Ms. Wingheyer, the language currently says the records at the request of the director. Could that be read?
When we
meaning as without directly saying it as soon as possible.
Madam Chair, when we request records, be it you call me and say your insurance company hasn't called you back on a claim you might have, or you call me and say you've been working something for 10 years and it's a huge problem, we give them very short time frames, usually 2 weeks, to say supply the data or call us and tell us why the data cannot be turned over to the division for further investigation or examination. We don't do it to hold consumers out of why nothing is moving. We are pretty strict on how much time we allow.
Thank you. Representative Sumner, no? Representative Groh.
If I could ask the chair's indulgence to ask more directly to the director. Would you suggest, Director Wingheyer, alternative language to make this as efficient as possible? I mean, in the sense of what you need to make this work?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, I think the bill right now is written that we can work it and make it work for consumers, that we can be efficient with the current wording.
Based on that, I'm going to withdraw Amendment 5.
Amendment number 5 has been withdrawn. Representative Groh.
I move Amendment 6.
Object.
There's an objection. Representative Groh.
So this is this proposed amendment tries to make this this process more of a conversation, a rubber stamp. And I learned this from one of my own bills that I proposed this year, House Bill 349, in that it's helpful with for the executive branch in dealing with an outside party to make sure that there's some dialogue and that you can have improvement occur. And so that's what this amendment tries to do. We're creating requirements for insurance companies about how to protect sensitive information required to hold the division insurance. What this amendment does is to allow the division to offer constructive feedback, which will ensure that all parties are working together to protect consumer data. This ensures we have everybody's an active partner in protecting Alaskans' private data. So based on that, ask Madam Chair for the director's views on this.
Ms. Wingheyer.
Madam Chair, to Representative Groh, I appreciate the amendment, and I think I understand what you're trying to do with it. As I look at it, I am concerned. I'm just going to back up here. When we do audits or examinations of companies, and particularly surplus lines audits, and if any of you want to hear 5 hours on surplus lines, I'm happy to talk. But it would basically be a company that, like Lloyd's of London, great company. By statute, if a broker sells you a policy from Lloyd's London, they've got to tell you that this is a non-admitted company in the state of Alaska, not covered by the Insurance Guarantee Association, and that they could not find an admitted carrier to put in Alaska to write that insurance for you. When we see these, and when we go in and do an audit, if someone has not complied, we tell them, you missed this and this, please be more careful. And when we go back in, if you haven't done it, I don't remind you of what we ask you to do. No, then we're talking fines and penalties because you are not giving consumers the notice to make a choice. And you have put them in a position that it possibly could not be covered by the Guarantee Association. So we don't go back and we go from being, if you will, nice to being regulators and saying we're here to protect consumers. That's our job. And we have to enforce the rules you have given us by statute and regulation. And so reminding them of what we have done before, we might do that, but it's not. We're moving on to the next phase.
Okay.
Representative Groh.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair. So, Director Wingheyer, Can you talk more explicitly about what that means here, of what you think would, as I said before, will make it most efficient for the division? This language tries to help do that, and I just want to make sure, given this important area of the law, that we're doing it the right way. Do you have additional thoughts?
Certainly. Through the chair to Representative Groh, the current bill allows us to do examinations and investigations. So we will have the right to look at insurance companies or brokers to go in and actually do an examination to see that they are, that they've got the corporate governance and the policies that are in this bill. That's an examination. If I get a call that says there's been a breach and all of our data is now out in the public for anyone to see, including based on that bill you just heard a minute ago, now all the data is out there. Now I've got an investigation going on, and my four investigators, possibly the FBI, certainly the Department of Justice, will all be in looking at this matter. So I think in this case, for us to, I think the way the bill is written gives me what I need. And I think, you know, I'm saying that also, that this bill was written originally at the National Association of Insurance Consumers. We spent over 2 years vetting this bill with industry, with regulators, working with NCOIL, insurance legislators, and such to bring it back to pass here. And so I think that had it been that somewhere through the process, other legislators that were involved, stakeholders, industry, consumer groups, if there'd been a concern, I think they would have brought it up, sir.
Thank you. And based on that, I'm going to withdraw Amendment 6. Thank
Amendment
you.
Number 6 has been withdrawn.
Can I make a comment?
Vice Chair Allard.
Your candor is so grateful. So thank you. It helps us a lot, and I just can't say enough about it.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So that puts Senate Bill 134 before us as amended. Does the bill sponsor wish to make any final comments?
Through the chair, I just want to say thank you to the chair and the committee for hearing this bill. It's carrying some important improvements that we can make to our data security, but also with the inclusion of the mammography language can bring some pretty important things to Alaskans. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if we could hear, I see Nancy Harris is here, and we have indirect court rule amendments. So if we could perhaps hear from Mrs. Harris about... Mrs. Mead. Apologies. Nancy Mead. Yeah.
Ms. Mead, if you would please join us at the table.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. We have no problem whatsoever with the bill. I was here in case there were questions on the direct rule or indirect rule changes. These are rule changes the legislature makes in the normal course because you're changing legislation, and part of that legislation creates privileges and says by statute certain documents that the director will gather are not discoverable in a civil action and not admissible in a lawsuit. That has the indirect effect of touching the court's rules of evidence and what is discoverable. And so the notation in Section 4 of the bill is normal and not problematic whatsoever from the court's perspective.
Thank you, Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Mrs. Mead. Sorry about that. Nancy Harris was the real estate commission.
Sure. No problem. Thank you.
Any final comments from members? Brief at ease. Back on the record. Okay, for clarification for the public, we received a message from Legislative Legal that the conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 1 does not exactly align with the language in the bill, and we want to get this right. So, Vice Chair Allard, if I could have a motion.
Rescind action on Amendment 1.
Hearing no objection, Amendment Number 1 has been rescinded.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Gray.
I rescind action on Conceptual Amendment 3 to Amendment 1.
Hearing no objection, Conceptual Amendment Number 3 has been rescinded.
Madam Chair, I move conceptual amendment 4 to amendment 1 on lines 3 to 4 of amendment 1, remove the words, quote, and without unreasonable delay, end quote, and replace it with, quote, and not later than 10 business days, end quote.
Hearing no objection, conceptual amendment number 4 to amendment number 1 has been adopted. That puts amendment number 1 as conceptually amended before us. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, amendment number 1 has been adopted. Thank you so much to the keen ear of our legislative legal services. I really appreciate that. Just when we think that they aren't paying that close of attention, I'm amazed at how they multitask. So, Vice Chair Allard, do I have a motion?
Yeah, you do. It says, Madam Chair, I move that the House Judiciary Committee move SB 134 version 33 LS 0253/H from committee as amended with the attached fiscal notes and give Legislative Legal Services permission and technical and conforming changes as necessary.
I have a comment.
There's been an objection. Representative Groff.
I just want to thank Senator Kaufman and Director Ringheyer for their work on this legislation, as well as the staff of Senator Kaufman in terms of a lot of work that went into this. And thank you.
Do you remove your objection?
I remove my objection.
Hearing no further objections, Senate Bill 134 has moved from committee. We do have a couple other, thank you, Senator Kaufman, Ms. Wienheyer. We have a couple more administrative items that should take about 2 minutes. So I ask that if we could take a brief at ease. Back on record. So we will now take up House Bill 105. There was a previous fiscal note for this resolution that was inadvertently, or this bill that was inadvertently left out from members and put on the record. So we will make a motion to move it out again with this correction. It is a zero fiscal note. It is before the members now. So Vice Chair Allard, if I could have a motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that the committee rescind action as passage of HB 105.
Hearing no objection.
Object.
There is an objection. So, Representative Gray, do you object to rescinding action?
I'm going to want to vote on everything.
Okay. So, Representative Sumner.
Madam Chair, I'd just like the member to be clear on what we are voting on. To rescind action would be to not report the bill out. So if the member opposes rescinding action, then he supports that we reported the bill out.
Okay, would the secretary please call the roll on rescission of House Bill 105?
Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Chair Vance.
Yes.
4 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 105 has been rescinded. So House Bill 105 is now before us, and I'm stating for the record that there is a new zero fiscal note before us and will be attached to move out of committee. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee move the CS for HB 105 version 33-DH-1072/S from committee with the newly attached fiscal note, zero fiscal note, as you were.
There is an objection. Would the secretary call the roll on House Bill 105?
Representative Carpenter is not present. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Representative Allard. Representative Allard.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
3 yeas.
With 3 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 105 has failed to move from committee.
Right now. Fettes.
Back on the record, Representative Sumner.
I move to rescind action on my vote to report out HB 105.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the Secretary call the roll on rescission of House Bill 105?
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
4 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 105 has been rescinded. Vice Chair Allard, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that the committee move CS for HB 105 version 33JH 1072S from committee with the newly attached zero fiscal note.
Object.
House, there has been an objection with
Brief
the second.
At ease.
Brief at ease. Would the Secretary please call the roll on House Bill 105?
Representative Groh.
This is moving it out of committee? No.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Yes. Representative Sumner. Yes. Representative Gray. No. Chair Vance. Yes. 4 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 105 has moved from committee. So we will now take up House Bill 107. There was a previous fiscal note for this resolution that was inadvertently left out from members and put on the record, so we will make a motion to move the resolution out again with this correction made. Vice Chair Allard.
Did I get a copy of this fiscal note? I'll make the motion first. Madam Chair, I move the committee to rescind its previous action of passage of HB 107.
Object.
So there's been an objection. Would the Secretary please call the roll on rescission of House Bill 107?
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Representative Allen.
Pass.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
4 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 107 has been rescinded. It is now back before us, and I'm stating for the record that there is a new zero fiscal note before us and will be attached to this bill moving out of committee. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee move this CS for HB 107 version 33LS0482. From committee with the newly attached zero fiscal note.
Object.
There is an objection. Would the Secretary call the roll on House Bill 107?
Representative Sumner.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Groh.
No.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter is not present. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
4 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 107 has moved from committee. Phew. Well, that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee has concluded its business at this moment. I do believe that we may have another bill up on Monday, but we will provide the committee that information. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect as 3:14 p.m. Please stay to sign all of the reports.